Hello and welcome to History for Weirdos.
We're your hosts, Andrew
and Stephanie,
and each week we're going to take you on a journey into the strange, obscure, and relentlessly entertaining corners of human history.
Now listen up, friends, because it's about to get weird.
Welcome, weirdos, to episode number 110 of History for Weirdos.
Yay!
Guys, so glad to be back, as always. And you know what? Before Stephanie gets into her incredible episode she has this week, which you probably already know since you've read the title of the episode, she gave me a sneak peek, guys, so I'm really interested in this one. I'm invested. But before we go into it, I just wanted to give you guys a quick reminder. The trip to Italy is coming up. It's in April of 2024. The deadline's quickly approaching. It's December 18th, so make sure you sign up ASAP.
That's a month away.
It's a month away now.
Time's running out.
Time is literally running out. Not only on this trip, but in our lives.
Oh my God, that's too deep.
No, I'm just kidding, guys.
But we really want to see you on the trip, so please sign up. And all the information, as always, is in the description of this episode.
Right, you can find it in the show notes in the hyperlink. Okay, now that we have that out of the way, Stephanie, what do you have to share with us? Even though I'm asking this question, I already know the answer.
Yes, you do. I want to say I'm so jealous of how much energy you have.
Yeah, guys, I had a... So
oh,
I was,
you're drinking a pre-workout.
Yeah,
that's why.
That's why I'm so amped. Because, guys, I was like dead tired earlier.
And we spent
like
the whole day with family today.
Right. And I had to like really... I'm not a fluent Spanish speaker. So we were with your Mexican family. And mm-hmm. So like there was a lot of Spanish being spoken. And I was trying really hard to like translate into my head.
Okay, but who was actually translating for you in real time?
Okay, that was you.
Yeah.
And you did a great job, by the way. But I was also translating because I was like, I really want to be better. Mm-hmm. I really want to actually be fluent.
I feel like your skills are pretty good and your comprehension's really good.
It gets better really quickly.
Yes.
Like, there's a very quick ramp up period where it's like, oh, wow, like within 24 hours, I'm much better than I was before.
Yeah, that's so true. It's so interesting how they say this all the time, linguists. Immersion is the best way to learn, is just being surrounded by it.
It's true. I mean, it's really tiring, but at the same time, I like got a lot better really quickly.
All of this is to say we're a little bit tired recording this episode.
But I'm amped.
But Andrew's amped because he was smart and is taking a pre-workout right now.
A pre-workout to record a podcast episode.
Yes.
It's just so ridiculous.
Not as wise. I do not have a pre-workout and it's my episode. How lame. I should have made a cup of coffee or something.
Yeah, that was... interesting choice on your part, babe.
I know.
Well, you know what?
So this will be, I don't know, consider this kind of like a atmospheric...
It's like chillax.
Chillax vibes. Not like NPR, but cozy.
Cozy.
NPR's too formal
it's
for
too
us.
Too like ASMR also. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Hello.
You are listening to History for Weirdos.
Yeah,
that's... A podcast...
by Stephanie and Andrew.
Yeah.
You can listen on anywhere you listen to podcasts. You have to have those really long pauses where you're like, mm-hmm. Are they going to continue talking? Or
yes. Or is it over? What's happening?
Yeah.
We won't be that chill, but I think this will be a chiller vibe.
But the subject certainly isn't.
This subject
well, at least not the end.
It's not chill at all, my friends. It's not chill at all. So this is very conflicting. This is also a very convoluted introduction, I'm realizing.
Yeah. Basically, long TLDR, or TL, that didn't make any sense, but if you didn't listen, basically, I'm amped, Stephanie's pretty tired, and we have an interesting episode.
Oh,
let's go.
God.
Oh, also, sign up for our damn trip. It's going to be fucking fun. I mean, shoot, I can't believe I just cursed. I try not to, guys. Yeah, I'm really amped. Okay, let's go.
Okay. So, this week, we are going to be discussing... Lady Jane Grey. She was a Tudor queen, famously known as the 9-Day Queen. That's right, 9 days. Her reign lasted from July 10th, 1553 to July 19th, 1553. Unsurprisingly, she is the shortest ruling British monarch.
That's pretty cool, though. At least she ruled in the summer, so it was warm.
That's very true. Anyway.
That was like a Theo Vaughn-esque comment right there.
So let me tell you that Lady Jane Grey arrived at the Tower of London to prepare for her coronation that week in July. But in less than a fortnight, she was instead declared a prisoner instead of a queen. She was declared a prisoner by her cousin. I'll get into those details later. And let's just say it all really goes downhill for her from there.
Talk about like a glow down.
Yes. We're going to be talking about all of the background stories that led to these events, as well as learning more about Lady Jane and her life and legacy. And at the end, I'll also be discussing the painting that inspired this week's episode.
Oh, wow. I actually didn't know about that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm intrigued.
Yeah. So let me start off with some background. Lady Jane Grey was born in October of 1537. I saw like 37 or 38 for whatever reason. Records of that time were always weird like that with birthdays.
Right.
But around October 1537 in Briggate Park. Oh no, I can't say this. Leicester? Is it Leicester again?
Yeah, I think it's Leicestershire.
Leicestershire? Oh, our British weirdos are like rolling right now.
Yeah.
In England. I don't know how to say the...
Let's just go Leicestershire.
It looks like, for the non-British folks, it looks like it's like Leicestershire.
So it's probably... You butcher that, babe. You always make fun of me when I butcher Spanish words. This is rough.
This spelling's funky.
Yeah.
So someone is definitely going to tell us in the comments on Instagram how to actually pronounce this. I already know.
Yeah.
Lady Jane Grey was the daughter of Henry Grey, the first Duke of Suffolk, and Lady Frances Brandon. So her maternal grandmother, Lady Jane Grey, was Mary Tudor, the youngest sister of Henry VIII, making Lady Jane Grey a great-granddaughter of Henry VII.
Oh, nice.
Mm-hmm. And from an early age, Lady Jane Grey displayed remarkable intelligence and a strong interest in learning. Her education was very carefully supervised by her parents, and she became well-versed in subjects like literature, philosophy, theology. She was also a polyglot.
Oh, wow.
You're going to think this is cool. She was fluent in Greek, Latin, Italian, Hebrew, and of course English.
Wow, that's really incredible.
Right?
So she was incredibly gifted.
Yes. She was particularly fond of writing her letters actually in either Latin or Greek.
Ah, there we go.
A classics girly.
You know what? And of course she only rules for 9 days. Like the best ones.
Yeah, that's very true.
The best ones just don't last.
I think the more I learned about her, and hopefully for you weirdos as well, you get kind of more endeared towards her, too.
Oh, man. I told you guys this was going to be a little bit of a rough one.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting.
So through the influence of her father and her tutors, she became a very committed Protestant and even corresponded with the Zurich reformer Heinrich Bullinger, a very famous theologian of the time who would eventually be the head of the Church of Zurich.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. In general, by the adults in her life, she was seen as smart and well-behaved. She had a strict upbringing, which was really typical of young noble ladies at this time. A scholar who was visiting her family, named Roger Ascham, found her on the grounds one day reading Plato, and he went and was just like talking with her.
Dude, I would have loved to hang out with Lady Jane Grey.
Mm-hmm. Here she's a young teenager when he finds her.
Okay, maybe not. That'd be kind of weird.
But she seems like an interesting person. So he finds her and he wrote that Jane complained to him of the following, quote.
This is going to be good.
For when I'm in the presence of either father or mother, whether I speak, keep silent, sit, stand, go, eat, drink, be merry or sad, be sewing, playing, dancing, or doing anything else, I must do it as it were in such weight, measure, and number, even so perfectly as God made the world, or else I am sharply taunted, so cruelly threatened. Yes, sometimes with pinches, nips, and bobs. In other ways, which I'm not to name or bear them here. That was his note. Like,
right.
Other punishments that he didn't want to write down. And then Lady Jane grins it, ends it, that I think myself in hell.
You know who I think she would have gone along with, who we did also an episode with or on?
Who?
Hedy Lamarr.
Maybe, yeah.
I think they would have gone along famously.
But I just think this quote is so sweet because she's saying, like, whether I'm quiet or talking, sitting or going and doing stuff, like, I never do it perfectly enough for them.
I feel like
every teenager can relate to that.
Yes. You stole the words of my mouth perfectly.
She was like, at the end of the day, just a teenager. That she's like, they're so annoying and they're so on my butt that I feel like I'm in hell.
Right. And it sounds like she was incredibly intelligent too.
Yeah. Like they should have really been chiller with her.
Yeah.
But that was definitely not the case. So after this, around February of 1547, Jane was sent to live in the household of Thomas Seymour, the first Baron Seymour of Sudley, who soon would marry Henry VIII's widow, Catherine Parr.
Oh, wow.
After moving there, Jane was able to receive educational opportunities that she wouldn't have had access to otherwise, and she was able to socialize in court circles. So this was important. It was actually common practice in the Tudor period for aristocratic children to be brought up in other households as well as their own, especially if the, quote, foster family was of higher status than yours.
Right. That makes sense.
This would give the children opportunity to learn etiquette as well as maybe find a marital match or a patron if they were an artist.
Right. You're rubbing elbows with high society.
Mm-hmm. So let me tell you a little bit more about Thomas Seymour, actually, okay, before we move forward. So Thomas Seymour, really interesting guy. He was the brother of Henry VIII's third wife, Jane Seymour.
Yes, that's how I knew that name. That was the one he was in love with.
Yes. Well, he was in love with all of them at one point.
But I mean, yeah, that was the one he like loved, and she died.
He loved her because she gave him a son.
Right. Mm-hmm. Guys, Stephanie's face right now is so unamused. It's actually making me quite amused.
I cannot stand Henry VIII.
I thought he was your favorite monarch of all time, of any any like nation.
He's my personal nemesis. Okay, so I don't even want to talk about it. So Seymour is Jane Seymour's brother. And then, as I mentioned, he actually marries Henry VIII's widow, Catherine Parr.
Okay.
He was also one of the appointed noblemen who went and met Anne of Cleves.
Oh, wow.
Henry VIII's wife before Henry ever saw her. He was like sent to confirm, like, is she cute though?
Okay, so he's the brother of one of his ex or wives, and then he also like sourced another one of his wives.
And then married another one.
Oh my God, okay.
Yeah, I wrote, basically this dude was all up in Henry VIII's business.
Yeah, sounds like it.
He's really tied or trying to be very in the inner circle.
Clearly.
This also makes him King Edward VII's biological uncle, right? That's the little boy that Jane Seymour gives birth to and then dies. So he has high status already. But right. He is a very ambitious man.
Yes.
He brings Jane Grey, our Jane, into his house because he realized that this could be profitable for him. Both Jane and Edward are children at this time. But when they reach maturity, he planned to be the one to arrange a marriage between them. So he'd have connections to both of them. Both would think fondly of him, right?
Right, exactly.
And Jane at this time is third in line for the throne. So he saw her as just like a valuable asset to have in general. And he wanted to keep her close. Edward VII was 9 years old when he became king and therefore too young to rule by himself. So a council of regency was formed, led by Edward's other uncle, Edward Seymour.
Oh my God.
Okay. So there's the two Seymour brothers.
Right.
Both very ambitious. And guess who was not happy that his brother gets to like rule in the king's stead?
Thomas Seymour.
Thomas Seymour. He's pissed about it. He wanted that position for himself. And for reasons that are not clear, maybe to take the young king away and keep him in his own custody, I really couldn't figure it out. Thomas Seymour one day breaks into the young king's private apartments.
Okay, that's really weird.
Yeah, on the night of January 16th, 1549. This moment of idiocy, as I saw it quoted, I loved that.
It is.
Proved disastrous for him. He was arrested, sent to the Tower of London, and it seemed like having his brother in a position of high power did not help him because he was executed.
I mean, I think based off of what you're saying, it sounds like he didn't do anything to stop it. And yes. If anything, it sounded like he maybe even nudged.
Yeah, he might have been like, great. Because if one less person to compete with for power.
What that instantly reminded me of, weirdly enough? Tell me. Watergate.
It reminded me of Game of Thrones.
Basically the same thing.
Yeah, very similar.
Political intrigue, mm-hmm. Just set in very different
places. Eras?
Yeah, I was going to say
places. Atmospheres? Yeah.
Atmospheres, that's probably the better word.
Mm-hmm. So Thomas Seymour is executed in 1549. So then Lady Jane Grey, she's got to go home, you know, because he's dead.
Yeah.
And she no longer has the prospect of marrying the king, which is probably a bummer to her parents. Not so much to her because she's a literal child.
Right. She is just like, well, I just want to like study Greek. And
I literally just want to read Plato and you guys are up my butt.
Exactly.
So then in 1551, that was my tangent on Thomas Seymour. We're getting back to Lady Jane Grey's story.
Fair.
In 1551, at age 15 or 16, Lady Jane Grey marries a young man named Guildford. Such a misfortunate name.
Guildford
Dudley. He is the son of John Dudley, the Duke of Northumberland. And Guildford, I believe, was about 18 years old. So they're at least like kind of close in age.
Right.
This is a young age, right? If she's married at 15 to be married, but I just want to say that this would have been really typical for the time, especially for young women to get married at such strikingly young ages. So interestingly, Lady Jane got married alongside her sister, Catherine Grey, and her sister-in-law, Catherine Dudley, in a triple ceremony.
I was going to say a mass wedding. That's usually you saw those in antiquity, like that happened quite often, but like not.
Really?
Yeah, not medieval. Yeah, famously, Alexander the Great had married, like, kind of forcefully married all of his generals to, like, so these are, like, ethnically Greek generals to
Persian women, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And most of them got divorced. Most famously, Seleucus ended up staying married and then founding, like, a dynasty that would last, like, the Seleucids for, like, 300 years.
Wow. That's incredible. I'd heard of Alexander the Great doing that. I hadn't heard of that practice really anywhere else.
I guess to say it's common is, that's the most well-documented. It happened a couple other times.
Okay.
But, like, that's documented. So I just assumed that it happened more.
But you
than
don't
that.
Hear about it in, like, a Christian world, really.
No.
Yeah.
No, definitely not.
I've heard of sisters, like, getting married or twins kind of getting married together. But this is interesting because it's sister Catherine and sister-in-law Catherine in this triple ceremony with Jane. I just found that so interesting.
Yeah.
I guess all the parents were like, let's save on the expenses here.
I mean,
let's do something economical.
Yeah. The dads are having a big brain moment there.
Yes. So we don't know much about her married life, but Jane did describe herself in a letter as, quote, a wife who loves her husband, end quote. That's pretty good.
I mean, straight to the point. Very laconic.
She did also admit in letters that she resented her mother-in-law, the Duchess of Northumberland, because she had a lot of control over Guildford.
Oh, that's rough. Oh, so he was a big time mama's boy.
Exactly. Not super attractive, but Jane was a woman who loved her husband, end quote.
Maybe she's being very political.
Yeah. So this marriage was orchestrated, obviously, as most marriages were, for political reasons.
It wasn't out of love?
It's not out of love, sadly. Both families sought influence and favor within Tudor court. right? So Lady Jane Grey's marriage to Guildford Dudley connected her to the very powerful, very wealthy Dudley family, and she connected his family to the line of succession.
Okay.
Okay. So this plays a role in the events to come. Next up, sadly, shortly after being married, Lady Jane Grey's life takes a dramatic turn. So that same year, King Edward VII, her cousin, nominated her as his successor.
Wow.
This would be completely disregarding his half-sisters, Mary and Elizabeth.
Yeah.
So quick background here. We've talked about this, but just to summarize, King Edward is the only surviving son of Henry VIII by his third wife, Jane Seymour. And Edward is the first English monarch to be raised as a Protestant. That's very important.
Right.
He was against his sister Mary, who's older than him, taking the throne because she remained a devout Catholic, yes, like her mom, Catherine of Aragon. Catherine of Aragon is Henry VIII's first wife.
Who's also married to his brother.
Who was married to his brother first. His brother died, and then everyone was like, it's okay, they didn't consummate the marriage. Here you go, marry the brother.
That's such a weird line of thought.
Such a weird move. So this is the wife, the Spanish wife, that Henry VIII divorces for Anne Boleyn.
Yes.
Separating himself from the Catholic Church, right? So all of this history is why the young king chose to change the line of succession to prevent a Catholic monarch from retaking the throne. And Jane's new father-in-law was definitely instrumental in that decision within court.
I see.
The Papa Dudley, I don't even know homie's name, but whoever he is, he was like, well, you know, your cousin Jane's a really devout Protestant. She's my daughter-in-law and I've seen it. So
it's interesting too that he passed up Elizabeth, who was also a Protestant and older than Jane Grey, right?
I think she might be older, or they might be around the same age.
Regardless, a half-sister, though.
A half-sister. However, Elizabeth's legitimacy was always in and out of question.
Right, because she was the daughter of the second wife.
Not just because she's the daughter of the second wife, but because the reason that Anne Boleyn was executed was because of false claims of adultery.
Right.
So people would argue that maybe Elizabeth wasn't even Henry's daughter.
Got it. Because, yeah, obviously, like, Edward is the result of the third wife.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's really messy.
It's very messy.
These Tudors did not have their stuff together.
No. The Tudors would need a tutor in just being human beings.
Yeah, having, like, healthy family dynamics, because they did not have them.
Oh, my God. They could have used you, actually, like, plugging Stephanie's therapeutic business in here.
Plugging my therapy services.
Yeah.
You know?
You charge them in U.S. dollars, and they're like, what's that?
And be like, and the pricing is adjusted for inflation, guys. Don't worry about that. And they're like,
that would be bad for you.
No. I'd charge in modern day prices.
Oh, got it.
Charge them in modern day U.S. prices. And they'd be like, why is it so much? It's inflation. Okay.
It's inflation. Don't worry about it. God.
I love this imaginary scenario. I could not be a good, objective, ethical therapist to Henry VIII because I would just be like, I hate you so much. I think you suck. That would be my assessment of him.
But tell me how you really feel.
He was so terrible. All of these moms that we've mentioned, all these wives, everyone's moms, he'd screwed them over.
Yeah.
And just because he was selfish and impulsive.
Guys, if you couldn't tell, Stephanie's Roman Empire is the Tudors.
That's what Andrew said to me this week.
Yeah, it 100% is.
You think so?
My Roman Empire is
the Roman Empire. Yeah,
it's the Roman Empire, I guess. But also, it's also the Roman Republic, too. So that's why I just say ancient Rome.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I had to translate some of Andrew's passions today to my family. And I was like, oh, es que Andrew is muy, muy, muy obsesionado con el Imperio Romano.
Yeah, like I'm obsessed with the Roman Empire.
Yeah, muy, muy, muy,
like,
muy.
Like, and I mean literally obsessed. Not yes. just like have an interest in, like obsessed.
That's why I hesitate to claim the Tudors as my Roman Empire, because I look at you and I'm like, I don't think I'm that obsessed about anything.
I have like an unhealthy obsession. So, you know.
It's a hyperfixation.
It's a hyperfixation, exactly.
Mm-hmm. But let's get back to the story. Yeah, sorry. We're on a lot of tangents today, guys.
It's my pre-workout.
So, again, it's King Edward's decision. I imagine the adults in the room are the ones that influenced the freaking 15-year-old, or however right. old he was, to do this.
Exactly.
So the whole Privy Council literally signs off on this. There's like a document making the new line of succession. So then King Edward. King Edward VII dies of tuberculosis at the age of 15.
Yeah, I knew that was coming.
In 1553. And just a plug, we covered TB in a previous episode. You should go check that out after this one. It has taken the lives of many historical figures. So after his death, Lady Jane is taken to London, right?
Mm-hmm.
And once she arrives, they tell her, guess what, girl? You're the new queen. And then everyone just kneels in front of her. Okay. No one told her that the line of succession changed.
So she had no idea. Wait, so why did she go to London then in the first place?
Her family was just like, oh, the king died. Like, we have to go. You know, like.
Oh, right. Oh, to pay the respects. Oh, so she knew he died. Yeah. She didn't know that she was next in line.
No.
Wow, that is a crazy turn.
Why would a room full of men tell a woman about a decision they made on her behalf, right?
Right, that's a fair point. Why would she need to know that?
Why would she need to know that? So she arrives, they say, guess what, you're the new queen. And then everyone starts kneeling before her and she faints.
I don't blame her, because that's wild.
Mm-hmm. She fainted, she passed out, and when she finally came to, she reportedly got up and stated, quote, the crown is not my right. It pleases me not. Mary is the rightful heir. But apparently, these words did not matter much, because on July 10th, she's taken, as I mentioned at the beginning of this episode, to the Tower of London to prepare for her coronation, where she would be officially proclaimed queen.
That's ironic.
But that does not happen. And then, guess what? While this is going on,
what happens?
Her husband, Guilford, is like, hey, babe, can I be proclaimed king?
You know, that reminds me of The Crown.
Yes.
Remember when Elizabeth II's mm-hmm. Husband, I don't even remember his name. Gregory.
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah, Philip.
Mm-hmm.
When he's like, I want to be king.
Yeah, I want to be king consort, right?
Yeah.
Like, because his title was prince.
Yeah, I don't. Was he ever even granted that?
No, never. No?
Good.
Yeah, because it leads you to have, unfortunately, a stake in your spouse dying.
Yeah, that's weird.
That's very weird. So Guilford's like, hey, babe, can I be king? And Jane was like, oh my God, absolutely not. That's so awkward that you even asked me that.
As she should, honestly.
And this really, she was like, I can't make you king, but I'll make you like Duke of Clarence. I guess it's a fancy duke to be. Her mother-in-law was pissed.
Dude, I don't like this woman at all.
She not a fan of her. Basically, you could see that his side of the family pushed so much for her to be moved up in the line of succession just because they thought they could swoop in with their son, Guildford. They thought Jane wouldn't be queen. They thought Guildford would just take over as king, that she would kind of be submissive and be like, oh, okay. But she didn't do that. And while all of this is going down over in London, Mary Tudor, so this is Henry VIII's eldest child, the Catholic one, is pissed.
I was going to say, she's probably quite incensed.
She hears the news and she is not happy. She writes to the Privy Council and demands they make her queen. And they were like, oh my God, this is super awkward because we're the ones that signed off on making Jane queen. What do we do? So they don't really do anything. And Mary gathers a lot of support from the noblemen who are loyal to her, because she is the eldest child of his first wife. So like technically she really is the true, quote unquote, true heir.
Right.
Based off their rules, right? And once word starts to gather that Mary's kind of riling up these nobles, Lady Jane Grey's supporters scattered. They flee London. They are nowhere to be found.
What cowards.
They knew that Mary had really powerful support and they wanted to save their own necks, so they abandoned this teenage girl.
So they literally just were like, okay, let's get her to power. And then the moment that things are just slightly
inconvenient,
tough,
yeah.
Right. They're just like, okay, sorry, child, that we like put on the spotlight, even though you didn't want it and you said you didn't want it. We're now just leaving you, you know, in the wind.
Yes, exactly. Which to me is so stupid. I don't have a better word for it, because when you all agreed to make this move for your own agendas, whatever that was, how did you not immediately think, okay, what are we going to do when Mary gets really upset and tries to contest this?
Yeah. Did they just not have any sort of strategy whatsoever? It sounded like they didn't.
No, they were just like, we're just going to say Jane's queen and then everything's going to be fine, right?
How can you be in the position of power like that and you have like considerable power and you just are a dunce?
That's a great question. Well,
I mean, I guess you look at the U.S. government and you can get your answer.
I was about to say, I don't think we have solved that problem yet.
That's true. That's a very fair point.
Yeah. So then Mary rides into London with 800 men at her side.
800? Not even a full 1,000? 800 only.
800.
That's like, that would be a tiny army.
Yeah. And her little sister Elizabeth's there. Elizabeth's like, what's up? She's just hanging out, I think.
She's with Mary?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
She's just there with Mary. They were chill at this time.
Okay.
Because Mary, when her mom was like ousted as a wife and Elizabeth is born and everything, Mary was actually sent to go live with Elizabeth. They didn't raise their kids at court.
Right.
To go with Elizabeth, and she kind of like raised her.
Wow.
Yeah. She kind of raised her sister. So Mary's there, 800 dudes are there, Elizabeth's there, and the Privy Council is like, oh my God, we changed our minds. We will totally be on your side. And they proclaim Mary as queen on July 19th, 1553, deposing Jane. Her primary supporter, Jane's primary supporter, her father-in-law, the one whose idea this was accused of treason, of course, and also arrested.
Right.
Lady Jane Grey remains in the Tower of London and is told, oh my gosh, you're no longer awaiting your coronation. You're actually being held prisoner and you're considered a traitor.
Wow.
Poor baby, right?
Even though on record, she's like, this shouldn't be me. This should be Mary by law.
Tons of witnesses could attest to that. So Mary Tudor feels bad. She feels bad for her little cousin. She knows that this is just a young girl who was a pawn in the game of ambitious men.
Yes.
She gets that. She knows the Dudley family, her new family, the in-laws, are just social climbers, basically.
Right.
So she's like, you know what? Don't worry about it. I'm going to spare you and your husband. It's totally fine. You just need to stay under arrest until I figure out what to do. So then several months go by and a special trial is held by a commission and both Jane and her husband are found officially guilty of treason. Lady Jane's sentence was to either be burned alive at Tower Hill or beheaded, depending on whichever pleased the Queen. So Queen Mary would get to this decide, but Mary really doesn't want to do that. And during this time, during these months that pass when there's like a council and everything.
Right.
This transition of power was not smooth, obviously, from the beginning.
Clearly.
So Mary's reign is already filled with uncertainty. And there are several plots to overthrow her within these first few months. And people are saying like, okay, we so much don't want a Catholic queen and like the Jane thing didn't work. Let's put Elizabeth on the throne.
Good idea, just a little too ahead of their time.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem like many are very loyal to Jane specifically being on the throne, but she still represents like a threat to the legitimacy of the reign because people proclaimed her queen and knelt before her and everything. So basically, Jane Grey becomes a liability that Mary can't ignore. So Mary's in a really tough spot and she says, okay, how about if you guys, you and your husband, both convert to Catholicism? And that way people won't see you as like my enemies, right? Like you won't be Protestants anymore. You won't represent like a Protestant monarchy.
Right.
But they were both really devout and they refused.
Wow.
They refused to convert and that sealed their fates. Mary officially sentenced them both to death by beheading.
This is Bloody Mary, right?
This is Bloody Mary. She was trying hard at the beginning to not be bloody, but she does some pretty horrendous things later in her reign.
Yeah.
She could be a whole other episode.
Yeah, she could.
So Jane's husband, Guildford, he actually makes a final request to see Lady Jane and say goodbye before they're both executed, and Mary grants that request, but then Lady Jane refuses to see him. She said that it would be too hard to say goodbye.
That breaks my heart.
Yeah. Because she's 17 and he's like 19 or 20. They're young.
They're kids.
They're kids. And obviously have some sort of fondness for each other.
Right.
So on the 12th of February, 1554, at 10 a.m., we found the timestamp. At 10 a.m., Guildford is taken to Tower Hill and he is executed.
Oh, man.
I know. Then due to her high status, right, she is a great-grandchild of Henry VII, Jane is offered a private execution. So, like, the public can't come in and watch, which they loved to do back in the day.
Right.
So there are people present, but it's, like, other members of the royal family and, like, her friends and family that are coming to say bye, basically. So Jane solemnly addresses those in attendance, stating, quote, "Good people, I come hither to die, and by a law I am condemned to do the same. The fact indeed against the Queen's Highness I was unlawful, and consenting by me, I do wash my hands thereof in innocency before the face of God and the face of you good Christian people this day." So she's basically like, yeah, I messed up.
You didn't mess up, baby girl.
You didn't mess up.
You're a child.
You're literally a literal child. The grown-ups messed up.
Yes, they're the ones who were the nitwits in this situation.
Yep, so she's basically like, I'm super sorry. I hope that this, like, gives me innocence, basically.
Right. That's also such an eloquent thing to say. Like, I cannot imagine saying something so eloquent today at 31 years old, let alone when I was 17.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree. I think I'd be like...
In the face of execution, too.
Yeah, I think I'd be like sobbing and be like, help, help, someone help.
I'd probably be like, I'm going to see you all in hell. Like, I'll put a curse on you. You're all going to join me, you mother...
Oh my god. Yeah. Just as elegant of an exit, my love.
Absolutely.
My favorite though is when Henry VIII had his 4th wife executed, young Catherine.
Yes.
The second one. Cuz she did cheat on him.
Yes.
With a guy by the name Culpepper. Her last words were like, I'm here standing before you, something like that, as the wife of a king, but I choose to die as the wife of a Culpepper.
Oh.
She's like, literally like, I freaking did it, you guys. I did it and I don't have any regrets.
No regrets.
She was also a child though. It is very problematic during the Tudors.
I know, the Tudors were...
awful.
I was going to say they were wild, but yeah, they were pretty awful too.
They are terrible. Okay, so back to Lady Jane Grey. She says that nice, eloquent statement, and then she reads a psalm from her prayer book. And then she takes off her gloves and her handkerchief, and she hands it to one of her ladies in waiting. She gives her prayer book to the lieutenant of the tower, and then they have to take off her gown, her dress, and her collar. She's not naked. It still would have been a lot of clothes for us, but basically it would have looked like she was in like a old-timey nightgown.
Right.
So the other ladies are helping her undress, and they blindfold her. And it said that she groped around for the block where she was supposed to lay her head, and she got really scared, and she started kind of shouting, "What shall I do? What shall I do? Where is it? Where is it?" Like, her hands in front of her, kind of like freaking out. And the lieutenant has to help her lay her head on the block. And she speaks her final words, "Lord, into thy hands I commend my spirit." And she is swiftly executed. Mary made sure apparently to get like a really good executioner with a really sharp blade.
Right.
So that it would go quickly.
Yeah, and dear weirdos, that was not a certainty in this time.
No, sometimes they'd have to hack at it for a while.
Yeah. I think when Elizabeth had Mary, Queen of Scots, executed, I think it took more than once.
Oh, that's my girl right there.
Yeah, it took a few times, I think.
No, my girl.
And not by purpose.
It's just more common.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That was just common.
I know that Henry VIII thought he was super freaking amazing and nice and awesome because he got like someone international to come and behead Anne Boleyn.
Yeah, bro. You're so nice that you got someone really gifted at killing people to kill your wife.
Because you got bored of her.
Yeah, you're so nice.
Yeah, he was like, wow, I'm really, he's like, you know what? I'll tell you this aside. He's like, I feel so bad about this. I'll plan her execution. I'm not going to go, ew, but I'll plan it. It's going to look really nice. I'm going to get her a nice dress to wear. He got her a dress to wear.
He's okay. He was psychotic.
Yeah. He was a psychopath. Sorry. I can't like talk about the Tudors without talking about how much I hate Henry VIII.
It might be hating Henry VIII as your Roman Empire.
Hating that man is my Roman Empire. That's very true. So sadly, Jane is only 17 years old when she's executed. Her remains were buried under the chapel in the Tower of London. And Jane's terrible fate has prompted many artists to create their own interpretations of her final moments. That scene apparently was really haunting for people, where she's like, where is it? Like, what do I do? What do I do? So one of the most striking depictions of this is Paul Delaroche's painting titled The Execution of Lady Jane Grey.
Okay, we'll definitely put that on Instagram.
Yeah, that seeing that painting and learning a little bit about it is what inspired this episode for me. So, as you can imagine, the subject of this painting is the execution of Lady Jane Grey. But it was painted in 1833, so nearly 300 years after the event.
Yeah.
And it was very striking to people at the time because it inserts a lot of detail into setting a very dramatic and emotive scene. So it conveys a lot of raw emotions, which it did for me.
Mm-hmm.
It shows Lady Jane Grey blindfolded, groping for the block. And there's one lady's maid holding her gown, weeping into it. There's another one who's like turned to the wall, like she can't look, and she's sobbing. You see the tower lieutenant, you see the executioner. I really highly recommend you look up the photo, or like Andrew said, we'll have it on Instagram. One of my sources for this episode, Joy of Museums, points out the following elements that you should pay attention to when you look at it.
Okay.
One is note the tenderness in which the lieutenant of the tower assists the blindfolded Jane to the execution block. Two is you can look and see the displeasure in the face of the executioner. And three, the grief of Lady Jane's two female companions as they sob.
I think if I was the executioner, like, I would hate, like, I would absolutely hate, like, the person making me do this.
That has to be the worst job ever.
Yeah, like, I think I would feel, like actual hatred for that person.
Yeah.
Like, I have to murder a child here.
I feel like the Ned Stark rule should apply. Like, if you are sentencing someone,
yeah,
you should have to do it.
Absolutely.
You'd do it yourself then.
Yeah, if you feel so strongly that you're going to have, you say, I'm going to kill this person, you do it.
You do it.
Yeah, I agree
100%. Mm-hmm. Something that's often remarked about the painting is that it looks like you're looking at a stage and these are figures in a play. The painting is also, I'd seen pictures of it before, but I saw a video of someone in front of the painting. It's life size.
Oh, the people so it's are massive.
It's really big. And it looks like a scene in a play. It looks like you, okay, if you didn't know anything about the history, mm-hmm. you'd probably look at it and think it's like a scene from Shakespeare.
Wow.
That's what it looks like. It's really beautiful, really tragic. She looks very like angelic and innocent, which she would have been at 17, right? You're a baby.
Yeah.
And it's a really cool painting. So we will share that.
Nice.
Lady Jane Grey has been viewed as a Protestant martyr for centuries. She's kind of seen as this like traitor heroine figure in history during the Reformation. I don't really see the traitor component, but she's, whatever. Yeah. Over the centuries, her tale has grown to legendary proportions in popular culture, in romantic writings, novels, plays, paintings, and films. So if you look up those things with Lady Jane Grey's name, you're going to find a lot of stuff. She's just unfortunately the victim of really ambitious men who gave no F's about her and her life.
gave no F's. That's a perfect description.
She was a pawn, like literally, like if they were playing chess, she was just a pawn.
Yeah, a pawn in the Game of Thrones. Mm-hmm. Like, ridiculous.
And that, my dear weirdos, is the story of the Nine-Day Queen.
And you know what the tragic thing about this, beyond her being murdered, is it sounded like she could have been a great monarch, actually.
She might have actually been a really great choice.
I mean, the fact that she's reading Plato, right? She's probably reading, like,
as a kid.
On the Republic, like, Plato. Like, mm-hmm. she probably had these great ideals of, like, what government is supposed to be, mm-hmm. you know, and it's supposed to help the common person, unlike, you know, her great uncle who was mm-hmm. just a womanizer and a booze hound mm-hmm. who did things for personal glory.
Yeah.
It would have been, it's honestly, that in itself is tragic. The loss of like a potentially great monarch.
I know. And the fact that, again, at a young age, it seems like she had a sense of right and wrong, because even though her cousin Mary is Catholic, is of a different faith, and people of that time really saw those differences as like, oh, we're enemies. Mm-hmm. Her first instinct after fainting was to say like, this isn't right, because this isn't my crown, this is her crown.
Yeah, I mean, that's a Jon Snow figure right there, right?
Yeah, we're
a lot of Game of Thrones themes here.
Well, that makes sense, because he based it off the War of the Roses, right?
So right.
Generations before, but...
Yeah, which had Henry VII yep. as the eventual victor.
Mm-hmm.
Victor.
Yeah, it's just very interesting. She reminds me a little bit of Anne Boleyn, in that Anne Boleyn, I was telling you this when I was doing the research, was such an actual believer in the Reformation.
Right.
She would write about it, like write letters to Henry VIII when he was trying to court her, like being like, look at what people are doing all over the world.
So she was was she homies with Martin Luther, you think?
I don't know if they were homies. She would have definitely admired him a lot, because she, before it was allowed in England, she had like her own private Bible. Like,
oh, wow.
It was just such a movement to democratize religion.
Yeah.
It was so important. And Henry VIII jumped on it, on the bandwagon, but for his own benefit.
Right.
Not for the benefit of anyone else.
I really think he did. I mean, the more I learn about Henry VIII, I understand why you hate him. It yeah. just seems like he was vainglorious
yeah.
and did everything to benefit himself.
And
not
no
the
one
common
else.
Man.
Yeah. And I don't think either of these women that we're referencing, Anne Boleyn or Jane Grey, would have done that.
I agree.
So it would have been better to have them in power, but they are both beheaded. So,
say love you.
And before we wrap up, Before we wrap up this very cheerful episode, let me share my sources in case you want to learn more. There's Historic Royal Places, very cool website, biography.com, Joy of Museums, And then I'm citing two TikToks, okay? But these are legit. All right. One is Dr. Amy Boyington. She's a very famous historian on TikTok now. She's written books and made courses on the Tudors and Queen Elizabeth specifically. And then a TikTok by historian Alex Loxton. She's the one who had the TikTok on the painting.
Oh, okay.
That I saw. So I saw her standing in front of it talking about it. And that's what inspired this episode for me. So shout out to Alex Loxton. And last but not least, Wikipedia.
Of course.
Of course.
When you told me that you were referencing a TikTok, mm-hmm. Two TikToks for this episode, mm-hmm. I was literally like, babe, are you kidding me?
But they're by historians.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, if someone had a podcast and they referenced my TikTok, I would be like, okay, fair enough.
Fair enough.
Fair enough.
Thank you so much for listening, weirdos. I hope, even though this episode was a bummer, I hope it was still really intriguing and informative, because that's how I felt researching it.
I love this.
Oh, good. I'm so glad, babe.
I love all your episodes.
I always feel so proud.
I might be a little bit biased, though, too.
When you like my episodes, I'm like, oh, thank God.
Well, I definitely loved it. I'm sure the weirdos love it. So thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you. And thank you, weirdos. Until next time.
Until next time. And have a great Thanksgiving to all our American weirdos.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Adios. This is the story of a girl who cried a river and drowned the whole world.